The production of this program is made possible thanks to the support of Audlin Brown, BD Developments, Stem Cell Technologies, and listeners like you. The Claims of Life, a new book by Diana Chapman Walsh, traces the emergence of a young woman who set out believing she wasn't particularly smart, but then went on to meet multiple tests of leadership in the American Academy, a place where everyone wants to be heard and no one wants a boss. The Claims of Life offers readers an unusually intimate view of trustworthy leadership that begins and ends in self-knowledge. During a transformative 14-year Wellesley presidency, Walsh advanced women's authority, compassionate governance, and self-reinvention. After Wellesley Walsh, interest took her back to the boards of five national nonprofits, galvanizing change. She kept counsel with Nobel laureates, feminist icons, and the Dalai Lama, seeking solutions to the world's biggest challenge, preserving our planet. I invited Diana Chapman Walsh to join me for a conversation that matters about a life that is open to endless possibilities. Diana, welcome.
Thank you, Stuart. I'm so happy to be here with you, and thank you for that kind introduction.
Well, I was struck by reading your book about how important it is to you that you do have this mindset that says, I don't have all the answers. Yes. Allow life to come to me and then give me the time and the resources to address those challenges. How important is it having a mindset like that, especially when you're in a position of running one of the most treasured institutions in the United States, Wellesley College?
Well, I think it's vitally important. And, you know, I brought to it a background of a person who sort of struggled when I was young to develop my own sense of self and self-confidence and all of that. But in the context of being a leader of an institution, there are so many different voices, all mostly strongly held, and all with pieces of a larger truth. And if you can bring those voices together, listen to them carefully, create spaces for self-corrections and for people to thrash things out together, you get so much richer and more useful a picture of what really is going on. The leader just can't possibly have the whole picture of the realities of this large institution with people learning and growing and so much intellectual activity everywhere. So that openness is critical.
Well, you write quite extensively about the process that you went through from having someone trying to entice you into accepting the idea that you might be the president. And you're going like, yeah, not likely, to embracing it. But when you move into that role, the level of responsibility is incredibly intense. And yet yes. You quoted the poet Wallace Stevens and said, you know, it's necessary to, you know, to any originality to have the courage to be an amateur.
Right.
Like that is a very courageous thing because it means that you're willing to say, I don't know. And
yes.
How difficult is it to do that in the position that you held for so long?
So one of the things that makes it difficult to do is one of the things that one has to learn early on as a leader, which is the way in which others in the organization project upon the leader the images they have of what a good leader looks like. And sometimes they're helpful images, and sometimes they're images that have as much to do with what those people who are making the projections think the organization should stand for and the directions it should move and all of that. So kind of holding a sense of self as the leader, being very open to input, but not looking like you're just sort of hanging in the wind and trying to react to every incoming input is challenging. And so that means going back into yourself. One of the things I said I would do to myself as I started was to lead from within. So to have a way of going back and rechecking when some challenging situation arose. Okay, where am I in this? How do I understand it? What new perspectives do I need to gather? Do I find corrections to what may be my own biases, my own gaps in knowledge, and to that sort of back and forth, going within for sort of reality checks, the courage to be an amateur. Part of the word amateur is love, going into your heart and trying to find out what it has to tell you. So that process, that back and forth process, was really important to me.
There still must have been an awful lot of moments of self-doubt when you're going, okay, the pressure's on. People want me to be able to adjudicate or make decisions around very difficult issues. What along the way started to give you the sense that you, even though you could say, I don't know, I have the strength, the resources, and the ability to find out and then come up with the right answer? What was it inside you that allowed you to get to that point?
Well, I write in the book, and early on in the book, and it was early in the writing process of the book I wrote over a number of years, and early in the process, I wrote a chapter that was really about the whole search process, about, you mentioned somebody called me and I said, I'm not at all sure. That process was very powerful, and I learned a lot during the process, and it again was very much back and forth. The search committee, I had a first interview that was not very satisfactory to them or to me. I hadn't really prepared much for it. I was kind of blowing it off. I didn't really think this was a real possibility. And then they called me back. And in between, they asked for many people to speak to them for references. And I sent a little note out to everyone who I knew had been asked to give a reference. And without a strategic thought behind it, but I just wanted them to know. And I also was concerned. I didn't want the word to get out too widely that I was looking. I was at Harvard in a relatively new position. And what happened there was most of the people to whom I sent a note and who talked to the Presidential Search Committee got back to me, and they talked about the questions that had been asked, and they talked about the answers that they had given. And this process changed me, back and forth with these people who knew me very well, who were talking to the search committee, who were hearing carefully what they were looking for, and who were thinking carefully about what I brought. And so over that process, I became more and more confident that there was a goodness of fit, that this committee was looking for largely the gifts and the talents that I had developed over time. So I had that going in, and I had a sense from the last meeting with the search committee that was really a remarkable meeting where we all just came together, and we knew it was as though the skies had opened and the sun was shining in the room, and we knew we were going to do this, and that I had a lot to learn, and that they would help me learn, and others would too, and they believed that it would work, and I did too. So it was a little magical in that way.
The production of this program is made possible thanks to the support of Audlin Brown, BD Developments, Stem Cell Technologies, and listeners like you. You talked about how that selection committee process and talking to all the people who you had put forward as references, that wound up changing you.
Yes.
And as a result, you then were selected to be the president of Wellesley. And then you walked into an environment that was filled with incredible challenges, shifting sands at all times.
Yes.
Is that the nature of a significant and large academic institution, that it's always changing, and it's incumbent upon leadership to not just sit there saying, well, these are my values from my life, but how am I also reflecting the needs of the students that are going to come here and in an effort to prepare themselves for their lives?
Absolutely. The sands are constantly shifting, and that's part of why it's absolutely essential that you have sensors out everywhere, and you're taking it all in as much as you possibly can, and processing it and talking to lots of other people and trying to make sense making is sort of a constant project. I want to just say one more thing about the selection process, because there was one part of it that's relevant to to what's going on now. So I, when I went for the second interview, before I went to a consultant. Somebody, a friend of mine, suggested it, and he sort of right. put me through my paces. He said, videotaped what I was doing, said, oh, that's just awful. You'll never get the job, and told me to work on preparing blocks and that I could answer, use as answers to whatever questions, all of that. And that was somewhat helpful. And he wanted me to come back. And I decided not to go back to him because I didn't want him in my head for that second interview. And if he had been in my head for that second interview, I would not have become the Wellesley president because I would not have been fully there in that interview. I would not have been myself. I would not have been taking in the interview in that space, in that room that where we just came, we fell in love with each other. We truly began, and I felt fully seen by that committee. It was a big committee, 23 people. I felt like they knew everything about me that was important to know, and that we would do this together. And the fact that they knew who I was a tremendous asset in the beginning. So if I had missteps or things that didn't work out. And I think that hearing that we've all been seeing over and over with the three presidents, part of what happened there was they were very overcoached, and they didn't get to be themselves. They had been told to be so very careful about one misstep. And every one of those three women could have said really moving and important things about what it's like to be in the situations that they're in.
I couldn't agree with you more. So often I do interviews with people and they go, well, give me the question so I can prepare answers in advance. And I go, no, that's not what I want. I want right. to actually see you think your way through this. I want yeah. the real you answering yeah. a question. And in doing so, what you're doing, as you have done in the book, you have opened up your mind, your thoughts, your feelings, your emotions, that in relationship to what are the issues of the moment. And you mm-hmm. can't do that by being overprepared. You rob yes. the audience and you rob yourself of the opportunity to genuinely express how you feel.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And the writing of the book for me was such an amazing opportunity to see things even more deeply, even more broadly, to understand them in a very different way. So I would, it was a long process, and I described a struggle, an incident. There were, as you say, constantly shifting, lots and lots of them. Some of them hilarious in retrospect, some of them not, some of them tragic and sad. But telling that story, but then reflecting on that story and sort of watching the process as the sort of evolutionary process through my life as those stories accumulated, the opportunity to wrestle with it and get it down into a book. The book that was accepted by the publisher was 100 pages longer than the book that was published. And so there was a lot of wrestling and shaping, but such a privilege to have been able to do that.
The production of this program is made possible thanks to the support of Audlin Brown, BD Developments, Stem Cell Technologies, and listeners like you. In your book, you had six statements about be yourself, be strong, be like, where did you develop that, and maybe share exactly what they are rather than me trying to paraphrase?
Yeah, that was fun. So after I was selected and realized that I had this very steep learning curve that I would be climbing for quite a while before I'd be in command of the situation, I had the summer, and we have a house on Cape Cod in Massachusetts, and someone had given me a pair of inline roller skates. I had never done that before, but I was an athlete and I was learning how to do it. So I was skating along the Cape Cod Canal, which is this place where the ships can come through. And I didn't intend to, but I evolved a kind of mantra. It was my mantra for Wellesley. And it was, each one of the items was something I was worried that might trip me up. So the mantra in the end, I can't remember the various different versions of it, but the one that stayed in my head was be tough, be clear, be honest, be fair, be true to yourself, and keep your own counsel. So be tough, because I knew that there would be moments when I would be very hurt. Something would happen and I'd feel horrible and I'd feel right ashamed. And I had to be able to manage those emotions. Be clear, to be crisp and say things that people could understand right away, and not, you know, I tend to use a lot of words. I'm probably doing it now. Be sharp and clear. Be honest, absolutely, always honest, you know, carefully thinking about the impact on the other person, but always trying to find the kernel of truth. Be fair, always even-handed, make sure. Be true to yourself. And that was this business of going back inside and checking for that gut check, that heart check. Is this okay? Am I thinking about this? Do I need to learn more? And keep your own counsel was just don't be gossiping. You know, I was so aware that you learn something new about somebody and it's interesting and you want to talking to someone else and it's an interesting story. And I couldn't be doing that. I couldn't be speaking about other people behind their backs at all, ever. That had to be something that I had to be very careful about, because in the role of the president, that would have a very major impact.
Well, in an academic institution of that scale and reputation, you also had a wide variety of different constituencies or stakeholders that you had to work with. How do you start to build the teams that you need that are each going to have a particular skill set that you can all work together? Because they have to trust you and you have to trust them. How do you put a team like that together?
Well, it takes time, and it's in the beginning, it's the most important task for the leader is to make sure that you have the right people, that they have absolutely the right skill set for the piece of the institution that they're responsible for. So the academic dean has to be highly respected by the faculty, clearly, and the dean of student life has to be very clear about the needs of students going forward and how that's changing and on like that, and this cabinet that I had. But then I spent a lot of time on developing partnerships with each of those people. So when I started out, even if it was somebody who was already in the job, but I now needed to make sure that that person and I were on the same page. So I'd sit down with them, and I'd sometimes do it with a third party there who was a consultant who didn't say much, but he's kind of holding the space so that we're sitting at a round table together and we're in a process of having a serious conversation about our partnership. And we would do that and talk about our expectations of each other, what we thought we were bringing to the partnership, what we thought we might need some help and support in bringing to the partnership. And we did that at the beginning. It was almost like a contract, but we didn't write it out, but it was a serious process. And then when something went wrong, we came back together. And one of the things that happens in an organization when the leader and some other member of the leadership and one or two other members, when they're coming with an agenda to change something, whatever it might be, and there's always, if you're going to improve the place, you need to be doing that. The system, reified, tends to resist change. People are pretty comfortable the way things are. And so one of the easiest ways to do that is to try to drive a wedge between the leaders, to make sure that these leadership team is coming at you. That's much more of a challenge to the status quo than if you can split them off from each other. And so that happens a lot, and you sort of start hearing rumors, well, over here somebody's criticizing the dean of students and somebody else is criticizing from a different perspective. And so we would sit down together, and it would often be an incident, some incident that was heated, and we'd sit down together and we'd sort it out. We'd actually talk about, okay, what did you see? What did you hear? What did you do? What did you hear about me? And how can we come back together again? So that was a constant commitment and a constant process that we had with our team.
The production of this program is made possible thanks to the support of Audlin Brown, BD Developments, Stem Cell Technologies, and listeners like you. When you were in that recruitment selection committee process, you wrote that somebody said, Diana, are you sure you want this? Because they don't want just you, they want all of you. All right. of you. All right. day, every day of the year. Is the job that all-consuming?
Yes, it truly is, yeah. You live in their house. It's a beautiful house. My husband used to call it public housing. It's a mansion, but in sense of it. And it was funny when he was a very well-known and distinguished scientist at Harvard Medical School. He'd been at MIT before that. And there were rumors floating when we first arrived that Chris Walsh would not go live in that matriarchy. He wouldn't move into the president's house. This is going to be a problem. We're not going to get the president to live there with her husband. Of course he did, but he would joke that it was public housing. So it was all consuming for me and in our marriage during that period, but he had his own very important world that he was leading.
When you look back on your career as the president, what do you take away from it as being the most satisfying accomplishments that you were, a part of helping to see the institution change?
Right. So there was a whole list of things that we, this wonderful team and I did, and it's an impressive list. We changed educationally, we changed the curriculum. We added a number of programs that I think opened up, one of the things the faculty were concerned about was the quality of intellectual life on the campus. Were people talking about ideas? Were they talking about the learning and the teaching? And we created structures for that to happen in different ways. We created new majors and all of that. And there was also something more ephemeral and harder to pin down, and that was the culture. There was a culture of perfectionism, a culture of kind of concern about making mistakes. And it seemed to me that was completely counterproductive to a community in which we were all trying to learn, that we had to be open to our fallibility and to the possibility then that we could learn and grow if we would be able to let go of some of the fear of making mistakes. So the goal of improving the culture, changing the culture, making it both more compassionate, more engaged and engaged with each other in meaningful ways, and also more focused on the joy of learning and the fun of learning was something that was a goal that I had in my mind. I loved Wellesley College. I loved it as a student and as the president. It made me who I was twice, who I am. But there was something about the culture that needed to change. And I think we changed it. I had a breakfast one day with one of our new trustees who was the head of the Boston Consulting Group. And I said, he asked me the same question you just asked me. And I said similar things about the culture. And he said, oh, be careful, Diana. Culture is very hard to change. But we did change the culture. I'm sure of that. And I think others are too.
Okay. Changing a culture, no matter what organization, is not easy.
Right.
And there are some people who go, okay, well, I'm going to push it to make it change.
Right.
But how much better is it to have I'm going to draw you in and in some ways, smother you with love. How important is that?
That's really interesting. That's well said. Yes, it was always with a light touch. I connected with people. I connected with, one of the things I did in changing the culture was I went around to all the departments at the beginning and I asked them all what it was that they did to contribute to the education of our students. And they all said, among other things, they were teaching students how to think, and they were in all kinds of ways. And I'd ask them about what brought them joy as teachers. And at the beginning, they would sort of look at me like, really? we're doing our jobs. We don't talk about joy and love and happiness. But over time, we started talking about those things. We had a new program in religious and spiritual life. It made them a little nervous over here, and it became an important part of the culture of the college. So we opened our hearts to each other, I think I can say, in a way that hadn't been going on before. And academics are a little suspicious of that sometimes, but it turned out that we all loved what we were doing, loved our work, cared about the students deeply, and there was a way to connect at a heart level that was meaningful to me and meaningful to many on the campus.
And you wound up with a common goal.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes. Well, thank you for sharing some of these insights, and your book is so remarkably intimate. I mean, you really allow me as a reader to get to know you, and you're magnificent. Thank you
so much, Stuart. I really appreciate your very generous reading of the book. That's what I hoped it would be, and I really enjoyed speaking to you today. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you for listening, and please visit conversationsthatmatter.ca and become a subscriber. And thank you to Audlin Brown, BD Developments, and Stem Cell Technologies for their support.